This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're talking all about men's mental health with licensed marriage and family therapist, Crystal DeSantis, who I really could not have asked for a better guest for this episode. And I really don't have anything to add to it because we covered a lot, including some thoughts I've had for a little while on how my perception on masculinity has kind of evolved and some of the funny, surprising conclusions I found along the way there. So no spoilers on that. One thing I will give a quick plug before we get into the episode. Nominations are ongoing for the People's Choice Podcast Awards. So if you've not already, you can go to podcastawards.com and you can nominate this podcast in the health category, in the People's Choice category, and Dating Games, the Modern Relationships podcast, in the comedy category. So if you haven't already, please go do that now. It makes a big difference in keeping the show going, keeping the show prestigious, which helps get in brilliant guests like Crystal, who so often now get pitched right into my inbox and came along with a new book all about relationships, described as a field guide for the modern man. And she really delivered on the insights. The book I've started reading is great. And so let's get into it. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar. With a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry, IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
My name is Crystal DeSantis, and I am from Austin, Texas. And let's see, when I first became aware of mental health, that is such an interesting place to go back to. You know, growing up, I really didn't have a lot of awareness of mental health at all. You know, I had no idea that there was such a thing as counselors or therapy or anything to do with mental health. So I really first became aware of my own need for mental health care when I was in college. I moved to the U.S. when I was 18. I actually grew up in Japan. And when I moved to the U.S., I went through a little period of depression. I was very much going through kind of a culture shock, feeling just ripped out of context, right? So I had grown up my whole life in Japan in this context that I was very familiar with, that I knew. And then I wanted to go to college, and where it made sense for me to do that was in America. So I left home by myself. I ended up staying with an aunt and uncle, but at that point I didn't really know them. And so here I was, like, in a totally different culture, living with people who I really didn't know very well. I just felt very disconnected. And so I just kind of sank into this kind of slump of, like, where do I fit in life? Where am I going? Who am I connected to? What is my context? Like, where do I fit?
Yeah. Who am I?
Yeah. And that was just a really kind of interesting experience for me. And that's kind of when I first, I think, became aware that, oh, you know, life transitions can very much affect mental health. And then after that, in college, there were a couple of times where I did seek out the campus counselor, which again was the first time I was like, oh, there's somebody I could actually talk to about this. And I really didn't have any idea that that was a thing that people did, mm-hmm. or that was a thing that a person could do for a profession. So that was really kind of my first foray. It was really experiencing anxiety and depression myself, and then seeking out somebody who was a counselor for a living and realizing that, oh, that's a thing that people do.
That's a thing that exists. And that is so beautifully articulated, that kind of culture shock. And in a way, it makes me wonder about the kind of cultural context that mental health is so a taboo topic in Japan in quite a distinct way, where it's seen as, you know, correct me if you think I'm wrong, but it can be seen as not only something that is that you don't talk about, it's something that's deeply personal. You know, like it would be seen as sort of, you know, maybe along the lines of like disclosing an STD outside of any context. Mm-hmm. Like you wouldn't tell your work colleague about that for no reason, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that is honestly, you know, I think in a lot of cultures, it's been like that, right? There's a stigma attached mm-hmm. to disclosing that you have any kind of mental health issue. Again, like sometimes mental health issues are medical conditions, right? But I think there's a broader conversation that I'm glad that we're talking about it more openly. There's more awareness that you don't have to be mentally ill to seek mental health support and kind of getting away from that stigma.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Totally agree. And that's partly why I was sort of thinking about the cultural context there, because the way you came to accessing support yourself sounds actually distinctly less kind of burdened by stigma than a lot of the guests I talk to, where there can be more of that hump. And I wonder if that was partly this experience coming from living in Japan and it just being so not a conversation, and partly that, that distinct feeling of, you know, why would it be? Why would people talk about this nearly? And then you get to a place where it is talked about more, but also the medical professionals are more accessible than you've been used to. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, oh, I'm having this new problem. There's somebody I didn't even know exists. What a pleasant surprise. And what a lovely, what a lovely contrast to a lot of the kind of, you know, the versions of stigma I hear about all the time.
Absolutely. Yeah, I remember in college seeing the therapist like in the dining hall and having a moment of like, what?
Because would you not be hidden away?
Right. Yeah. And so, like you said, in you know, especially in Japan or in any culture where mental illness is like so pathologized to the point where it's like you have to be at this certain threshold in order to warrant seeking mental health help.
Yeah. Right? It's nearly like it doesn't exist until it's diagnosable.
Yeah. Exactly. As opposed to here's somebody who's free on campus who walks into the dining hall sometimes, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a place that I really hope we get to one day, of it being this thing of like, why wouldn't I get therapy? Mm-hmm. You know, it just becomes a thing like going to the gym or, you know, eating healthy. It's just like, well, of course I'm considering it, you know?
Absolutely. And I think that's even an interesting comparison, because in Japan, gym culture really wasn't a thing. You know, obviously people are generally much more active. Walking is, you know, a totally viable mode of transportation, as opposed to America where there's mostly driving. But I remember, you know, there was a big drive towards like gyms are a thing that you do, right? Getting a gym membership in Japan. It was like brand new, like this concept. And then again, when I came to America, I came to college, of course, there's a gym on campus that's like free and open to use. And so I think just the availability and the normalization of like, yeah, there's not a barrier for entry. You don't have to be like, oh, you're, you know, trying to make a certain weight goal or training for the Olympics to be a gym member, or, you know, have a diagnosable mental illness to be able to access mental health help. It's like, here it is. It's available. If you need it, you can use it freely.
Mm-hmm. And then you're getting to not only avail of that, but see, oh, actually, maybe there's a career here I hadn't thought of. What was it you were studying?
So I was actually totally not. Well, I took a minor in psychology because I was always interested in psychology, human nature. Also, I think coming from a totally different culture, coming to America, I was kind of that outside observer where I really wanted to understand why the rules here were so different, why people interacted here so differently. So I took an undergrad psychology minor just to kind of understand, like, how do I exist in this culture?
Yeah, why did I keep jaywalking? What's this about?
What is this? I remember when, you know, in Japan, even, for example, the dating culture tends to be very, you know, it's different now, but when I was there, it was, you know, you dated in order to get married or to, you know, it wasn't just casual dating like in America. So I remember an embarrassing moment for myself when I was in America and a coworker, I was working at a sports bar, and she was telling me about this new guy that she was going out with. And I was like, oh, who are his parents? And she looked at me like, how did I know? Like, what a weird question, you know? And so that was those moments of like, oh, I don't understand how to interact here. So maybe I'll study it. So I did an undergrad minor in psychology, and then I did my major in communications degree.
I mean, there's less transferable things to counseling, to be fair.
Sure.
I can see it. And it's interesting. I've only visited Japan once, but, you know, I did the reverse of that, of, okay, before I go to someone else's culture, what things do I need to be aware of? What things, you know, just even little things. That's why I brought up like jaywalking, because there's this thing that from, you know, as a Western person is very, you know, novel, that until there's a green man, you don't cross the road, irrespective of if there's no cars on the street or not. You know, it's seen as like impolite or sort of rebellious in a way that here it's neither here nor there.
Absolutely. And I think that was the big difference, right? Is Japan is a very collectivistic culture, and then America is a very individualistic culture. Mm-hmm. So that, again, I think that also plays into my career, you know, doing relationship work, is like understanding the differences in cultural norms is also, something that I don't think we talk about enough.
No, I think that's good. And that distinct perspective of everyone is within their context. You know, there's a whole constellation of people around them. And as you know, so often people are in therapy to do with people around them who may or may not need to go to therapy themselves.
Absolutely.
And so as we swing into our theme for today, what was it about finding this specialism within men's mental health?
So before I went to college, I wanted to join the military. You know, one of those things where I was like, I think I could do that. No, do something different.
What attracted you to that?
I think, you know, in some ways, being an American raised overseas, the most contact I had with American culture was the military overseas. You know, if I saw an American, most likely they were there, you know, as part of the member of the military, or they were an English teacher. But so it was kind of like, oh, maybe I'll join the military when I, you know, go to America. And so I think just starting with that, I was maybe always more exposed to that culture, military culture. And then when I moved to the States, I ended up in California living close to a military base. And yeah, I just kind of started coming into contact with that population a lot more, and then becoming aware of the distinct needs of that population when it comes to mental health and relationships.
Right. Okay. So it became, rather than you going into it, you're like, okay, well, I'm clued in enough, and maybe there's a different way I can contribute.
Absolutely.
A lot of your first clients were military personnel?
No, it was a long journey. Actually, what I saw in California, especially living near the military base, was how many people got married super young. Mostly just to have somebody with them, right? So when you join the military, oftentimes, you know, it's the first time you're away from home. It's the first time you're away from, you know, your friends, your family, your culture. And you're in this totally, it might be the first time you ever left the state. Now you're in California. Now you're in, you know, this totally foreign context. And what I saw is a lot of young people that joined the military, they might be 18, 19 years old, is they would get married so they could bring somebody with them. You know, and then also you would have a little bit more privileges being a married person. You don't have to live, you know, on base necessarily. You could have off base housing with your spouse. And so I was just seeing all these really, really young couples. And then, of course, you add deployment onto that. And there was just like relationship issues all over the place. And it led to, you know, lots of depression, drinking, anger, cheating. You know, it was really very interesting for me to see all of these different relationship dynamics in this population, that I was like, wow, this feels like a lot.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it is such a distinct experience to be serving. And, you know, it is such a kind of echo chamber in a way that I think, you know, it's a whole different realm of things being brushed under the carpet, things going unaddressed with people's mental health. And I would imagine in many ways you got to see some of the extreme ends of narrow ideas of masculinity, i.e. like, absolutely, what does it mean if you're struggling with your feelings? What does it mean if you cry because of something you saw on a tour? is that something that reflects on your ability to do your job? Or is that a human reaction to a really tough thing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And again, the unaddressed trauma from being deployed or even from, again, being outside of context, it was very jarring to me to see, again, that a lot of people that join the military, you're just expected to kind of snap to, keep going. Like, you are a cog in a big machine. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't have time for you to have a personal reaction. Like, just let's go. Yeah. And the impact of that on the individual, on their family relationships, on their children, on their friendships, on their sense of identity, it was profound.
Yeah.
So I really then got a passion for working with that population.
Yeah. No, this makes sense. And it sounds like it in many ways would have given you such a great insight into modern masculinity. And I guess in many ways, US-centric masculinity. And so tell me a bit about then how that developed into practice for you. So you see men of kind of all backgrounds as opposed to specifically military, right?
Absolutely. But also one of the things that, you know, led my specific journey is, so my husband is a former Marine as well. So he was in the military complex. And when I met him, there was also a self-reflection of like, oh, I don't have any idea on how to do healthy relationships. Just, you know, personally, the way I grew up, you know, my parents divorced and, you know, very messy relationship. And so that was also part of me going to therapy, was I wanted to go to relationship therapy so that I could learn how to be in a relationship with my husband. And then from there is when I became a marriage and family therapist. Because again, I was like, oh, this is so cool. I can learn this stuff. And then I can learn it really well enough so I can share it with others. Yeah.
That's
so
lovely. That was I find that very admirable. And I kind of see that reflected.
Yeah. You know, with the work that I do now, the world has changed, very much changed in the last couple of decades. And I think, again, maybe with the perspective of me coming from a different culture, coming into American culture, seeing kind of these very, you know, with the environment that I was around, seeing these very young kind of traditional relationships that when you place them into context in the world, they didn't quite work out, if that makes sense.
No, I know what you mean, that a lot of the relationship ideals we may have been raised with don't necessarily hold up in, you know, dating apps. Like, we don't know how to translate a lot of the ways that maybe our parents, even just one generation, mm-hmm. met to then, mm-hmm. okay, how do we replicate that?
Exactly. Yeah. And so that is really the work that I do now, is deconstructing some of the maybe traditional relationship expectations so that people can have the relationships they want. And again, I always, you know, I like to say is, it doesn't really matter what it ends up looking like. It could look like a traditional relationship. It could look like a non-traditional relationship. It doesn't matter. What matters is, do you feel healthy and fulfilled and equal and empowered in the relationship, right? And that kind of shift from, you know, these are just expectations of a man in a relationship, a woman in a relationship, you know, even, you know, a gay relationship where it's like, well, you know, there are certain expectations that, you know, you just want to follow these scripts that have been handed down over, you know, the generations. And it's like, but it doesn't work anymore. So can we deconstruct what it means to be a man in a relationship, a woman in a relationship, a person in a relationship that is a partner relationship? As opposed to you stay in your lane, I'll stay in mine, and hopefully we don't hate each other in 40 years, you know?
No, I get that. And, you know, to share some of my own perspective on this, I, you know, was raised with a kind of specific wave of feminism from my mum, who is big in getting women into sciences and maths and engineering, different areas of underrepresented work. And that passionate feminism I grew up around is one of the most inspiring things about her. I can also see that to an extent it was also a sort of 70s feminism, you know, and so some elements of intersectionality were lacking. And so whilst I, you know, grew up in a diverse place, I'm from Ireland, but I spent a lot of my life in Birmingham in the UK, which is a very diverse city, you know, so that stuff I kind of picked up more naturally. But then I think one area that I've sort of, you know, over the years realized I wasn't always the best advocate for, and, you know, I think for my own self at times I could have needed to be, was, you know, thinking about the ways in which men can also be disadvantaged in our modern world. You know, that kind of 70s feminism of the men have had it long enough is absolutely important in terms of smashing glass ceilings. But then that also can't go to the extent of, well, the men are fine. They don't have any problems.
Absolutely.
They're getting most of the pay, and therefore that solves everything. And to do with my own kind of mental health stuff, at times it was easy to go along with twisting, I guess, that narrative. I'm not saying that that was distinctly that wave of feminism, but I think some of the ways in which I then took it was, who am I to complain? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's really, I totally agree with you. It's like the opposite end of dysfunction is still dysfunction, right? Just flipping roles doesn't necessarily mean that we've found balance.
And you reminded me of it because you were talking about, you know, finding equality in a relationship. And my mind jumps to, oh yeah, she needs to make sure she's heard. But that goes both ways. You know, that absolutely he also needs to feel emotionally heard if we're talking about an opposite gender couple.
Yes, 100%. And I think, honestly, that's really been where I think this new frontier is in men's mental health is, you know, because I saw, especially in American relationships, I'm not as familiar in some other cultures, but, you know, this idea of happy wife, happy life. And I put that in the opening preface of my book is, you know, it's crap. Like, you can't exist simply saying my needs don't matter. That will never lead to a healthy relationship. Of course, you know, again, there's nuance in that, you know, of course you want a, you know, happy spouse, happy house, right? It's like you want your partner to be their best self, and it cannot come at your expense. And I guess that's really where I'm seeing the shift in, you know, helping men find their power, their personal power in a relationship, embracing their personhood in a way that doesn't go back to this old mode of, okay, so I'm in charge, right? The dominant. Or it's like, no, now there's equality. And what does equality mean? And how can both people be empowered to be their best selves and form a relationship that is bespoke to embrace all of who both people, you know, are in the relationship, their best selves? So that nobody feels like, again, like one of the things I say is like, I hate the word compromise. I don't believe in compromise in a relationship. I hate it. I'm like, no, who wants to compromise? He's like, okay, would you like to, I promise to compromise for the rest of my life? Like, the world is our oyster now, right? And the people nowadays, right? People, like, you could do anything. You could move to another country. You could do whatever kind of job. Like, the world is your oyster. Why compromise, right? It feels like settling. And so again, that, you know, in order to have a relationship, and so I like to use the word collaborative, right? It's like the collaboration between two amazing artists. They create something that is bigger and better than either of them could do on their own. And I want to say, like, that's the goal of an empowered, healthy, strong relationship is, you know, how can I help you be your best self? How can you help me be my best self? And so that together we can create something that neither of us could do on our own. Right. But in order to do that, you have to work on, like, are you being your best self? What does it take for you to be your best self? Are there any unaddressed mental health issues? Are there any unaddressed past traumas or anything that is kind of blocking you from really being the person that you want to be and living your full life, whether in or out of a relationship?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that sounds lovely. Rather than compromising, you're kind of describing like a working together, like a coming together of two people and finding, okay, what things do we have in common? What things are we going to do to support each other? But ultimately, we want to do all those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's great. I want that relationship.
Yeah. Right? Don't we all? And honestly, that was something that I was looking back at, like the old traditional model of relationships. It kind of felt, you know, and it's interesting. I was talking to my husband about this because he grew up very traditional American, like small town American values. And just kind of, it's interesting when you stop and think about how ingrained some of these expectations are that, like, well, of course you're going to do blank. And then of course you're going to do blank. And then of course you're going to do blank. Like, of course you're going to get married. Of course you're going to have kids. Of course you're going to, you know, like, it's expectations. And to instead say, wait, hold on. when you really embrace your autonomy, when you really embrace your power, you get to choose what your next step is. It's not just a given that, okay, well, eventually you're going to have to settle down. Eventually you're going to have to, you know, the old ball and chain. It's like, no, if you want to, great. But I saw a lot of people really unhappy in relationships. And when, you know, especially in the work is, do you know why you're choosing this? Of all the things you could be doing in your life, why are you choosing this? Why are you choosing this life? And really, again, just especially for your mental health, I mean, one of the things that we know that affects people's mental health is feeling disempowered, right? If you feel like you're not having any impact on your world, you don't feel like you matter, you don't feel like your voice is valued, it has a really damaging effect on your mental health, right? And so in a relationship, if you as a partner, as a man, as a woman, whoever, if you don't feel like you have any agency, your mental health is going to really just take a nosedive.
No, you're spot on. And I think this is one of the ways in which, you know, it does intersect so much with narrow ideas of masculinity, right? That at a certain point, you know, this sort of old-fashioned way of seeing a man as kind of this box of a human that has allowed this many emotions and no more and doesn't talk about them, it is disempowering. And that then conflicts with men supposedly having power as part of it, right? Because, I mean, you get to see the extreme version of that with military clients, that so much of their masculinity is likely kind of tracking and sort of exacerbated by this expectation to be strong, both as men and also in their job. But what if strength is about not just being unpenetrable, but also when things go wrong, actually talking about it and doing something about it? You know, there's more than one type of strength. And we recognize that now, but the culture shift is still kind of ongoing, on reassessing, okay, we're still doing the men don't cry stuff.
And that's honestly why my book is called Strong, my practice is called Strong, is that I wanted to redefine strong, right? What does it mean to be strong in the modern world where it's not dependent on stoicism, you know, performance or physical strength? You know, I talk about this, that, you know, in the past, masculinity was kind of predicated on what we talk about, like the three P's, you know, being a protector, being a provider, and being able to procreate, right? If your wife wants babies, you better give them to her, right? Spread your seed, you know, be that guy, right? Your sexual prowess. These are the three things that defined masculinity, right? You're big and strong, you have a big, strong paycheck, and you have a big, strong penis. And again, you know, that is very narrow and doesn't really allow for a man to be a human being. I mean, this is one of the phrases I often say. It's like, you know, you can go out and be a hero, but when do you get to be a human, right? And so really, again, like, how do you embrace your strength as a full human without saying my worth is predicated on my physical body or my paycheck or my ability to perform sexually? Because guess what? All of these things are fragile. And they actually don't say anything about who you are as a human being, right? And so if these are your calling cards, and I think we see this a lot with like the manosphere stuff where it's like, you know, be the guy that, you know, is big and strong, and then be the guy that has the, you know, the most money, and then be the guy that's like the player. It's like, that is actually a losing game because there's always going to be somebody bigger, stronger, more money, and hotter than you eventually, right?
Yeah.
So again, just with men's mental health, like
also, I'm friends with so many of those people anyway, and they all come to me with their relationship problems. So like, if it solved anything, you're so right. And we can sort of talk about this stuff sort of objectively and know that so much of it is nonsense. And yet, you know, when it's so much a part of our respective cultures still, it's still very easy to soak up.
Absolutely.
And I was saying to you off air a little bit about one of the big surprises of this podcast even was that so many men related to me. And I really had to like do thinking about that because, you know, within mental health podcasting, within relationship podcasting, both of the shows that I host, it's predominantly a female listenership for shows like that. So I guess I sort of didn't think about it a huge amount beyond that until then. The work started to grow and I would hear from more men of how much they related to me. And when I examined this in myself, what I found a lot of it to be was that I had soaked this stuff up. So there's certain stuff I may not have believed in, the boys don't cry, boys don't show emotions sort of stuff. and so had kind of successfully opted myself out of so much of it, but I hadn't overridden me still seeing all the other guys in that way. And so I'd sort of assumed, okay, well, I just am doing masculinity differently. I'm just meaningfully deviating from it. And it's been an interesting thing to kind of see yourself in that light for years and then circle back to, oh, actually, turns out many of my emotional issues have been distinctly male. And that is the answer. That's why, weirdly, to me still, I can be relatable. And even, you know, not my words, but people saying it to me, I can be an example of, oh, you can actually step out of that. You can normalize talking about your emotions. That can be a part of your day to day. And your dick doesn't fall off or whatever the fuck. Like, we survive.
Absolutely. And it's funny because I was, you know, this is a phrase I'm like, I need to put on a t-shirt. It lands for everybody, but men are people too, mm-hmm. right? And that's just such a simple thing. But I think we've, like you said, this narrow box of masculinity is like looking at men as objects of performance rather than people, right? And again, it's like, well, this box of manhood has so much privilege. It's like, yes, but they don't often get to be people. Can we let men be people? And that means embracing your entire realm of human experiences, right? Not just anger, which goes in the box, but, you know, vulnerability, tenderness, nurturing, right? And just playfulness, like all of these things that are such an integral part of a full human experience that, whoops, doesn't fit in the man box. Get rid of it, right?
Yeah.
And yeah.
No, it's true. So, and I'm glad you've brought up male privilege because it's absolutely something that's so real, but not if we look at it in this narrow way of privilege, therefore means no hardship, because that doesn't track in anything. That doesn't work with financial privilege. That doesn't track with privilege of, oh, you were born in this country versus this one. Like, none of that actually holds up to any scrutiny. And instead, I prefer to describe privilege as a set of things that you may not have experienced. As a man, I'm less likely to feel unsafe walking home at night. That doesn't mean there aren't times in my life I might feel unsafe. Whilst it's an important concept to understand, it is not something that exists within a vacuum.
Totally. Absolutely. And that's where, like you said, the intersectionality is so important. You know, and when we talk about, you know, there's the, obviously we talk about this all day, but it's like recognizing the cultural context is really important, but then also honoring the individual's experience within that context is, you know, again, especially in my work as a therapist, that is the most important, right? Is, you know, we can talk about like masculinity as a concept and the way that has privileged men and how that has hindered men and vice versa. Like, you know, everything has, nothing is black and white.
Right? Yeah, you're like, the more we explain the complexities, the more you're like,
exactly.
There's actually very little we can sort of say out and out, you're a man, therefore this,
yes.
You know, but instead, yeah. Like I said, there's things that we can say, you're maybe less likely to have experienced certain things rather mm-hmm. than you're a man, therefore your experience is this single thing.
Absolutely. And I think the really important thing, and like you said, with, you know, the work that you're doing is also naming the cultural context that we all exist in and maybe the scripts that we've subliminally, like unconsciously allowed to impact our behavior and the way that we show up in the world and the way that we make sense of the world, right? Again, just naming things that might not have been named is one of the ways that, you know, when you can talk about things, you then are empowered to either choose the thing or not. But when you don't even know that you're choosing a thing because you don't even know that there's a choice, is, I think, where we lose autonomy, we lose freedom. I did a post for a 4th of July where, you know, the author Gabor Mate, he talks about, you know, are you truly free if your choices are subconscious? If you don't have the autonomy to name what you are choosing and what you are not choosing, then you're not really truly free. And of course, I just butchered that quote, but.
No, but I like that. Freedom is a thing to fight for. It's, yeah, not to be assumed. And I mean, even, you know, in America, we're having such reminders of that lately of like, freedom is never something that's a tick box and therefore everyone's free equally forever. You know,
absolutely.
There can be so many challenges to that freedom. And even this morning, I was talking to my flatmate about this, who was asking about what interviews I was doing today. And, you know, we were talking about this kind of idea of masculinity and how it's been something we've had to kind of find our own definitions on. And I was saying to him that one of the interesting things that flies in the face of a lot of these stereotypes is, for me, I think always, I've seen like one of the kind of pinnacles of masculinity to be like a family man, and not distinctly in the has kids, has sown his seed, whatever else. You know, maybe that element is there from how I was raised, but for me it's distinctly the caring side. It's the being a good family man. It's the like being a protector in a way that isn't just, okay, I'm earning money, I'm going to work, but it's also I'm spending time parenting the kids.
Absolutely.
I'm showing up emotionally as well as financially.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's really the work, you know, that I'm passionate about is, you know, allowing men to be strong, like inhabiting your masculine in whatever way works for you, but making sure that it's well-rounded and not one note, right? So being a protector, sure, you can be physically strong. You can take care of your physical health, but also, you know, are you able to be emotionally strong, right? Are you emotionally aware? Are you taking care of your mental health as well as your physical health? Being a provider, yes, you can have a paycheck and all of that. That's great. Like there's a certain level of stability that, you know, people need to provide for each other in a healthy relationship. But what else do you provide? Do you provide presence? Do you provide nurturing? Do you provide, you know, playtime with kids? Do you provide wisdom? Like you're not just one note. Like you're not just a paycheck. You are a multifaceted individual. So what else are you bringing to the table? Right. And same thing with procreation. Like you said, it's not just about, okay, sowed my seed, moving on. It's about being a fully involved parent, right? And you know, really being invested in that whole journey of, you know, what does it mean to be a father? What does it mean to be, you know, procreating, establishing a legacy, like much more than just, yeah, a one note checking of a box.
Mm-hmm. And so as we start to wrap up then, tell me about when you meet with new clients. And you see them come in with a lot of these sort of preconceptions and, you know, self-consciousness. And maybe a lot of the time that is elements of what am I doing here? I'm a dude in a therapist's office. Do I belong here? I don't know what I'm feeling. You know, there's a lot of insecurity that can come from not having that emotional language or, you know, practice being open. And so what sort of things do you start with your clients?
Love it. I have a
four fingers go up straight away.
Four essence of safety.
Okay.
Right. Because again, like we talk about safety. So the first one is self-awareness, right? Do you know why you're making the choices you're making? Right. So if they come in and they're like, I'm not sure about this relationship, do you know why you're in it? Right. Some self-awareness. And that also is, you know, do you even know what you want in life? Do you know what your values are? Right. If so, does your life reflect those values? So some self-awareness. Are you aware of how you're impacting your relationship? The second one is stability, right? What are some basic skills of stability that maybe are impacting your mental health, right? So if your job is uncertain, if you're not sure where you're living, if you're struggling just to take care of yourself, that could be indicative of maybe an untreated mental health issue or something in your life that needs a little bit more stability, right? It's really hard to learn to swim when you're drowning. So let's get you feeling stable. Right. And then the last two, which are really the relationship skills, is self-regulation. Right. So when you're upset or when you're feeling triggered, do you know how to calm yourself down and get back to a place where you're, you know, able to feel safe? Right. Because when you're triggered, basically your body goes into fight or flight danger mode. Right. And so you're acting out of a survival place. You're not acting out of a collaboration place. Right. And so again, just the little saying in this one is, you know, trauma rewires your brain from seeking connection to seeking protection. And so when you get triggered, if you don't know how to go back from seeking protection to seeking connection, you're going to struggle in your relationships. Right. And then the last one is that self-expression. And that's often just about expanding your language. You know, I say sometimes like men are raised with the like 8 box of crayons and women are given the 64, right? It's like women can talk about chartreuse and turquoise and magenta and men are like red, yellow, green, blue, black, you know? as when it comes to emotional language. And so some of that is, again, just validating, like, this is not because you're a man and you're somehow lesser. It's simply that maybe you haven't been given the vocabulary or the ability to practice using a wider range of vocabulary. So I have, you know, the emotion wheel that I'm like, you know, you can start in the middle, mad, sad, bad, fine, okay, and then expand out from there. So when you're mad, I feel disrespected, I'm feeling ignored, I'm feeling hurt, I'm feeling like, what is it that's making you upset? Anger is a very valid emotion, but sometimes it's like the big red crayon that just covers over everything. Can we find some shades in there? Right? And so just expanding language and normalizing that, you know, self-expression is a skill that you can learn. Some people have a head start. Some people were raised in families where emotional language was kind of given to them from the beginning, but a lot of us weren't, and that's okay. But you can learn it because it's a skill. It's not something that's inherently wired. Okay?
Yeah. You're so good. You really are. You really are. I could just like visualize you with your clients, and even just the way you talk, you're so calm. So like anyone that has anger issues, you're just going to be like, okay, and we're feeling it and we're not acting on it. Like I can just nearly see you in your sessions. It's great.
Well, I love what I do. I really do.
That's so good. I love it. No, it comes across, absolutely. And you've reminded me of something else talking about colors. So also talking to my flatmate, he said something really interesting about this idea of kind of what is masculinity and what isn't, and how, like, you know, he has like a pink pair of shorts that he wears to the gym. Sometimes he trains people to be personal trainers. His boss one time said to him, like, oh, look, you're so confident wearing pink shorts. And, you know, even just elements like that, we might not assume, because we can be raised with this kind of narrow masculinity stuff, that actually that was seen as a strength and a comfortability in his gender, as opposed to a, wearing a girl color, what's that about?
And I really love that because, again, emphasizing that, you know, the bravest thing, one of the strongest things you can do as a man is make a choice that is true for you that might go against what other people want you to be, right? And that, again, is that that's really true strength. It's saying, like, it works for me. I'm honoring my own values. I'm setting my own boundaries. And I'm living a life that is in alignment with those values. And if it doesn't look like your idea of what a man should be, or it doesn't matter, because I'm actually living my best life. So,
yeah. You know? Yeah. And I think we're also getting to a place where men are getting a lot less judgmental of each other, which is nice. You know, there's less of this kind of policing because, you know, the pink stuff has always been stupid, and it only really goes back as far as the 60s in the US anyway. So like, it's just so blatantly made up. Also, not for nothing, pink suits white people great, you know? So we'll start to wrap up there then. Is there any kind of final messages you would want to share with listeners who may be relating to this conversation and thinking, okay, now what? Your line is, buy the book.
Yes, absolutely. Buy the book. So I wrote a book. It's called Strong, A Relationship Field Guide for the Modern Man. It's got all this stuff in it. But I think the main thing is give yourself a chance. That's one thing I do see with men specifically, is sometimes they hold themselves back because they're like, you know, again, do I really meet that threshold where I deserve to be the person that, you know, chooses something, a therapist or a trainer or a coach, or do I deserve to really go outside of my box? And I really see that with a lot of men. And so I guess that's my message is, you know, give yourself a chance. Like, you only get one life. You might as well live your best life, but also living a life that's authentic and true and not just based on chasing some external values. Like, you deserve to have an experience where you are feeling really good about yourself, having really good care for your own mental health, living a fulfilling relationship. So give yourself a chance.
It's so true. It's such a common mentality of, I'm doing fine. I'm not sick enough.
Exactly.
I'll just keep plodding on. I'll keep being my little island. And also, you know, not for nothing, as I remind men in my life all the time, you know what, if you're looking to date women, you know what women love? Good communication, knowing your own feelings and them not having to tell you what you're feeling.
Absolutely. I mean, honestly, those four S's of safety is because, again, when I was observing couples, I was like, I don't think men quite, again, the way that men and women are socialized, and like you mentioned about safety, I don't think men understand how important safety is to women. Like, that is number one on almost every woman's list of, you know, what am I looking for in a partner, is somebody who can make me feel safe. And So again, I'm like, dudes, get these four S's of safety. If you can be self-aware, if you can be stable, you know, like how many couples go into like divorce court because of basic lack of stability? Because then a woman is like, I just don't feel like I can be settled in my home. You know, he can't keep up with himself. He's not able to watch the children well. And it's like, that's a safety issue. If you can get those skills down, like you're already cutting out like 30% of the fights you're going to have in your marriage, right? And the same thing, self-regulation, if you can be safe, even when you're angry, so that she doesn't have to worry that you're going to take it out on her, on the dog, or on the kids. Come on, again, you're going to be winning, right?
Yeah, no, true. Because, I'm just thinking muscles are all well and good, but we need to know we're safe with them.
Exactly.
You know, are we going to be on the receiving end of your strength?
Exactly.
Or are we going to feel safer with you?
And that's really the thing is that what I found is that women, you know, talk about like, I want somebody I can feel safe with, I can feel comfortable with. And when I broke it down into these four skills, that really encompasses all of what safety means and what it feels like in a relationship. So if you're a man who can be safe, again, it doesn't mean passive. It doesn't mean a doormat. It doesn't mean like, you know, wimpy. It means being able to have these skills of safety under your belt. Then, I mean, it's all gravy from there.
Love that. Oh, okay. Well, we're going to have to get you back on Dating Games, the Modern Relationships podcast. You need to be there. But for now, thank you so much for this chat.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ Mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to iqbar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's iqbar.com, promo code KELLER20.